Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
We also know that new types of jobs will end up getting creative, all these things. So I think it really is all of us to prepare for what's going to happen, get people ready, retrained, reskilled, repurposed as necessary, while we still have the runway to actually do it. But it's also a burden on all of us to realize that, I shouldn't call it a burden, it's an opportunity, actually. We can shape what this is going to be like. Rather than wait for it to happen, be the passenger, we can be the driver that leads the change. And so if you're really worried about losing your job, I really encourage you to take advantage of this opportunity to redefine what that's going to be.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with tech investor and business mentor Johan Noguera and with Chris Barrows-Brown of Upping Your Elvis, then do check them out, but only after you've listened to today's conversation. I'm really excited today to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest, Neil Sahota. Neil is an IBM master inventor. He's a United Nations Artificial Intelligence Advisor. He's a keynote speaker, author of the book Own the AI Revolution, and a professor at the University of California, Irvine. Over his 20-plus year career, Neil has worked with enterprises on the business and marketing strategies to create next-generation products and solutions powered by emerging technology, as well as helping organizations create the culture, the community, and the ecosystem needed to achieve success, such as the United Nations AI for Good initiative. Neil also actively pursues social good and volunteers with nonprofits. He's currently helping the Zero Abuse Project prevent child sexual abuse, as well as Planet Home to engage youth culture in sustainability initiatives. Neil describes himself as the Sherpa who unlocks hidden opportunities for self-disruption, the architect that constructs the bridge to those opportunities, and the counselor that creates a safe environment to manage risk and establish buy-in. In our discussion today, Neil talked to me about how the AI revolution is opening up new job opportunities. He described a bunch of applications that are already using AI for good and helping people. And we talked about the age of relationships and human connection. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Neil Sahota. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today from Irvine in California, in the USA, of course, Neil Sahota, who's president of Althena Systems and author of Own the AI Revolution. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Neil. It's a great privilege to have you as my guest.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Jürgen. I'm really excited to be here.
Now, Jamie Jay, who was our guest on episode 335 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we have a conversation with you, Neil. So big hello to Jamie.
Hey, Jamie, thanks for hooking us up together.
Yeah. Now, Neil, you've been a pioneer in artificial intelligence. You led the team, in fact, to develop the IBM Watson application, which is kind of one of the early well-known applications of artificial intelligence. So I'm really keen to explore all that with you a bit more, particularly in, you know, the impact that artificial intelligence has on all of our lives, our businesses, the human relationship aspects. But before we do that, can you give us a bit of a whistle-stop tour? How did you get into technology and what were some of the pivotal moments that got you into the artificial intelligence game?
I'll be honest, it was a total accident, Jürgen. I was studying political science and computer science in college. I know it's kind of weird.
An interesting combination.
I know, right? Computer science, I got started when I was 8 years old because I play a lot of sports, so my mom always told me, you got to be a little more diverse once you learn piano or a violin. And I told her I'd rather learn computers. So that's what wound up happening. So that paid off, so thanks, Mom. I really, in college, was thinking that I'd wind up going to politics. I helped a lot of people get elected the local, state, federal level, and I just realized I wasn't evil enough to be a politician. I hate to say it that way, but there was a lot of, it wasn't so much about principles, but about election, re-election, and lobbyists, and I decided that wasn't for me. And so I took a different path about trying to solve problems and wound up going to management consulting. And I remember working with, folks at like Disney and all these, Allianz and big companies about 15 years ago talking about like, it's amazing what computers can tell us. And it's like, they're not actually telling us anything, right? We had this business intelligence back then. It's like we have cool technology to store lots of data and create nice looking reports. I started thinking to myself, could a computer tell us something? Could it look at data and figure something out? And that actually set me down this path of artificial intelligence. So total accident.
So in a nutshell, can you describe what you understand by artificial intelligence? Because I think people have got all sorts of weird conceptions of it, which are probably formed largely by science fiction movies where you've got some robot walking around and trying to take over the world.
The Terminator
brings up all these scary scenarios.
I can assure everyone the Terminator scenario is not possible right now. There's a lot of definitions when it comes to AI, but very simply put, it's a computer that you give it a task that requires some low-level cognition, and it can perform the task without any human supervision. So it's basically a computer that we've taught something to do, and it only does it when we tell it to do it.
And so essentially there's got to be a step-by-step process, and it's a repetitive process. Ooh, hard to say.
Well, that's the interesting thing, Jürgen. It's not that it necessarily has to be repetitive or a step-by-step. Machines actually learn differently than we do. And so what we do is we give it something called a ground truth. So rules on how to make decisions, not the decisions themselves. And then we give it lots and lots of data. And kind of like how a person learns, it looks at all this data and it takes the ground truth and it starts seeing patterns. And that's how it starts realizing, okay, here's how I make decisions. So the AI is only as good as the data we give it, the ground truth we set for it, and the training, the coaching, the people get it as it tries to do something or answer questions. But real AI has the ability to try and answer a question or that we don't know the answer to. That's what really sets it apart from just automation.
Okay. So what do you mean by ground truths?
Well, think about this. So there are all these kind of like guiding principles or things that drive how we make decisions, right? And that's what the ground truth is. So if we think about, okay, how do we insure someone, right? Let's say it's an auto insurance policy. We might factor in where they live, their age, past driving history, right, to figure out a quote. And then, if they get into an accident, we have to look at certain things and say, okay, who's at fault? What are the traffic laws? And so we give the machine some of these, like, they're essentially like facts and say, well, here are the laws on accidents. And we say, like, the way we assess insurance policy, the premium or your assess paying out a claim is based on these factors. Maybe it's age, the type of car, was there a safety recall? So we have to factor all these things in and not just say, like, here's a checklist of stuff to look at, but you have to understand who's the driver. So how do you assess the driver? Where is this person driving, or where the accident occurred? So geolocation information. And that's really how you do it. And it's not an easy thing to do. When it comes to AI, there's always two big challenges that I've seen. One is, do you have the data to teach the machine? But two, the actual training strategy around how you teach the machine. That's where people tend to fumble.
All right. Well, taking that example then, I mean, you talked about that it's not actually really easy to do that assessment and come back with a tailored quote for that particular driver and car owner, which I'm guessing before artificial intelligence was the role of an expert, an insurance assessor, or I'm not sure what the job title would be, but somebody who's an expert in doing this thing. So there's a job there. Now, if the computer starts doing that, what is, you know, I mean, the classical thinking would be, well, that job's gone, right? But I think you probably think a little different. So what are the options there?
That's a good question, Jurgen. So I believe they're called an actuary in this case. It's not that an actuary would just completely disappear. Think about all the easy assessments that aren't done. They really probably don't need to do them anymore, or they would spot check something. So I'm just making this up, but let's say it takes them 4 hours to do an assessment on a policy for a person. Now they might spend 10 minutes on it, right? The machine is doing a bulk of the work, and the more complex cases, like maybe the person has a disability, or, you know, they're in a very, you know, rural part where there's not a lot of data about driving, or maybe it's a new type of car. Whatever, you know, kind of the more complex cases would really be fed into the person than the machine. And so they're working on more, you know, complex work or higher value work, or maybe they can spend more time actually talking to the clients and working on claims assessments and relationship building and that, right?
Yeah, I think there's a huge opportunity there. And that's the one where I think people kind of lose the perspective that, you know, where something is out of the ordinary and where the relationship is really important to grow and invest in order to give personal service, that's where time will be available now a lot more.
Well, I think that's really critical, because we always talk about the need for collaboration and for our FaceTime and relationship building. I mean, think of a doctor, right? At least in the U.S., they're under the gun about seeing so many patients per day and how much time they spend. It's limited because they have to file a lot of paperwork. You give them an AI tool that offloads some of that kind of admin grunt work, that actually frees up. Like, every second they get freed up, they can actually spend that second with a patient. So you give a doctor even 5 minutes back per patient, that could be the difference between life or death. I mean, I hate to say it that way, but I remember, you know, I have a cousin who's a doctor, and there was some patient complaining about problems and, you know, shuttling one specialist after another. And my cousin was raised with, you have a really good bedside manner, and he started talking with the patient. Probably spent like 45, 50 minutes talking with his patient, and probably way beyond what he was supposed to, so I was given trouble. But at one point, the patient mentioned something like, you know, he only drinking water, but he always uses his favorite cup. It's a cup he made back in high school. You know, he made this class, and my cousin's like, well, tell me more about the cup. And so he started talking about the cup, and he realized the cup was made out of lead. And so he was actually suffering from lead poisoning as a result. Right? Never would have figured that out if he didn't spend the time talking to him.
Yeah, that's a great example. And sort of diagnosing a problem that the cause is actually something that you only discover through a relationship and a deeper conversation.
And I think that's true in any industry now, is that whether you're a doctor, you're a lawyer, you're an accountant, a marketer, a salesperson, financial analyst, we're realizing that the power of relationships are far more impactful and far more valuable.
And of course, we're realizing that a little bit now in the time, you know, we're still in the middle of this pandemic and social isolation and various stages of lockdown, and people are getting a bit stir crazy because they can't get out and foster those relationships in person.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Well, we're finding clever ways though to do that. There's, you know, you talk about AI. There's actually a lot of use now in trying to see, can we use AI tools to bridge some of those gaps? There's actually a startup company called Cyrano AI, started by a therapist and a neurolinguist. And that's been my experience. The best AI startups are not started by technologists, but by domain experts. But they originally wanted to help depressed and suicidal teenagers. And they're like, you know, can we create an outlet, a safe space for them to talk? And they wanted to create an AI to do that. And, you know, long story short, they built an AI engine. They wanted testing it first at a car dealership because they realized, well, if there's something bad happens, a teen's life could end. But if we do a car dealership, the worst thing that could happen is a sale doesn't happen. Hmm. And they were actually able, just through the language, be able to assess people and say, this person is planning to buy a car today. This person is planning to buy a car within a week. This person's just window shopping. They're probably not going to buy a car for at least 6 months. And they were 30 for 30 during their pilot. And so that's actually evolved now into kind of an AI communication coach. And they've actually launched a Zoom plugin about a month ago that now when you're on a Zoom call, you can actually get the kind of the psychographics about a person. And so talk about virtual relationship building. Imagine having a conversation. Afterwards, you know, everyone gets like a report that says, okay, hey, Neil is this type of person. He likes to learn this. He cares about these types of things. Like he cares more about value over bells and whistles. And when you talk to him, you have to focus on kind of the business case or the ROI. And you should use these types of words when communicating with him. So kind of giving you some of those subtle clues that we kind of lose without the face-to-face interaction.
Hmm. Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So how does that work? It basically analyzes language?
So it analyzes language, not just the words, but the syntax, the grammar, sometimes the tone of voice, and actually will deconstruct kind of your personality, your emotional state. But they can also assess then your level of commitment, how you engage with other people, how you best learn, what actually matters to you. Right? It's like, you know, if you were to invite me to a party and say, hey, that's awesome, I'll be there, versus like, hey, that sounds pretty good, maybe I'll swing by, right? There's kind of saying the same thing, but the intent behind it is actually quite different. So imagine being able to pick that up at a much more subtle level.
Mm. Yeah, and of course, language is very powerful, and there are, I mean, the neuro-linguistic specialists have the ability to pick up very fine nuances there, and it's quite amazing. I've spoken to people that have the ability to do that, and when they feedback something to me, it's pretty scary, in fact. So I imagine that with AI, you can be focused on the conversation and be listening and less worried about those nuances, which you might have to spend all your cognitive chunks on concentrating on, so you're not actually listening to the conversation from a relationship point of view, but that can be offloaded to the machine.
Absolutely. And look, I like to call it a communication coach because, you know, my better half, the person I love most in the world, she and I still get into little misunderstandings and discussions. And here's a little, you know, AI. Because sometimes can tell me, yo, Neil, you're not talking about the right things. This is not what she cares about. You need to focus on this. But you can also, I mean, expand this out. I mean, we talk about marketing and sales, but you think about like law and legal depositions. You know, your doctor and working with a patient and saying, are they going to stick this type of treatment, or how do I convince them they have to change some behaviors, right? What's the best way to engage? So it could be a really powerful tool for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, the initial intent to recognize signals in language of people's intent when they're, you know, facing bad times, dark times.
Yeah.
All right. So what are some of the other examples where AI is already being used?
Well, there's not a sector or industry out there that there's not something being done. There's still plenty of opportunity, don't get me wrong. But I think what's remarkable is where it's actually being applied through, like, disruptively, that's shocking people, right? Like, law is one area. A lot of people thought, well, you can never really apply AI, maybe for some back-end operations or something like that. But you actually have guys that have created, like, essentially AI lawyers. They can actually pick up some of the work. There's another company called LegalMation where they've actually started by three lawyers. Again, you know, best companies I've seen, not technologists necessarily, but they created a lawyer, an AI lawyer, that if someone files a complaint against you, like they bring a lawsuit against you, their AI can actually take the court information, the complaint, analyze it, you know, do some legal research, but also start generating the deposition questions, preparing the interrogatories, and start figuring out case strategy. And it takes the AI about 2 minutes to do what an associate lawyer, maybe 3 to 4 years of experience, probably take about 10 to 12 hours to do.
Yeah.
And they had a really interesting situation where one of their clients is Walmart. And Walmart had a customer who bought a whole chicken. And ironically, this guy was a dentist, because when he bit into the gizzard, he hit a stone and broke his tooth. So he sued Walmart. Normally, Walmart would probably settle, you know, I don't know how much, I don't know, 80,000 maybe, I have no idea. But because now they're using this LegalMation AI lawyer, they, you know, the complaint got run through, and, you know, the AI prepared the stuff, but the case strategy actually pointed out and said, it's actually a material fact that when chickens eat, they eat stones. And so by biting into the gizzard, you should have been aware of the risk that you might bite the stone and suffer injury. Walmart used that argument in court and won the case. So rather than paying all this money out, they actually won against the lawsuit. And I remember asking, you know, some lawyers, like, do you think a human lawyer would have figured that out? And they're like, unless that guy was a chicken farmer, no way.
Yeah.
They probably wouldn't have figured that out.
Yeah, it's a bit like the lead cup, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Unless you dig really deeply. Although here it wasn't down to the relationship. It was uncovering facts that probably only a chicken farmer or somebody that knows chickens really well would know. Mm. Well, one of the ones that I use a lot now, and this fascinated me when it first came out, is one that's built into one of the photography apps I use. And there's actually 3 or 4 different settings that they actually label them AI, but it's a whole combination of settings. So on the software, you can set the brightness of the scene, you can set the contrast of the scene, you can set the brightness of the bright areas, the brightness of the dark areas, and so on. There's a page and a half, and then you click there's a page and a half of settings, but then you click drop downs on each setting as well, and then you get hundreds of settings under that. So to really understand this software, you have to be a genius. It's very complex, and it probably turns a lot of people off. And with this one, so I generally had about a dozen settings that I worked with, and I thought, well, if I focus on those and if I get a good result, that's good. Otherwise, I just get overwhelmed and takes up a lot of time. Well, now they've got about 4 settings that are AI settings that combine a whole range of different things. And so you just basically take the slider of a couple of them, and there's one that works on the whole scene, and they haven't kind of let out all the things it does, but basically you just take the slider and the photograph transforms.
Nice. It's
like taking something that's really dull, and all of a sudden, you know, and it's like I've spent an hour working on all different settings and exploring settings. And often I used to explore different settings. I wonder what this one does. And then, oh, that actually improved some aspect of the look. So I did that. But then an hour later, I'd have a photograph that I was happy with, whereas this is like a couple of sliders and it takes a minute.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, maybe one day it'll just be all voice, Jürgen. It'll just be like, more vibrant colors, you know, do this.
That's right. Yeah. And they've even got where you can replace the sky.
Wow.
So if you've got, if you've got imagine this beautiful scene, but you've got a perfect day, so it's just blue sky. Well, that doesn't work too well. I mean, there's this expression, postcard clouds. So you can actually replace the sky and put in clouds or turn it into a stormy scene or turn it into a night scene, and it's totally seamless. It's brilliant.
That's awesome. But now you kind of wonder what the real picture originally was.
That's right. Yeah. All right. Well, when we last talked, you talked about you mentioned a couple of times today about most AI startups not being founded by technologists. So really it's people who've identified, hey, there's a problem here or there's an opportunity to improve some aspect of what we do. What prompts those people to say, well, let's explore AI, and how do they go about it?
It's interesting because it's a bit of a mixed bag. You've got some people that they're just fascinated by technology and they're kind of first of a kind. So they learn a little bit and then they realize they can do something with it. And then you got some people that they know that they should be doing something. They just don't know what it is. And they reach out to people like me for help to figure that out. But we still have a lot of people out there that think, right, there's a lot of smart technologists out there, and there are, but they're going to tell me ultimately what I need. And the challenge with that is, as smart as those technologists are, they may not really understand the problems of your space, of your industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, I haven't met many technologists that know a lot about the problems a doctor faces or an accountant or even a marketer. And so, you know, AI, we're talking about it's driving this fourth industrial revolution. It's no new form of computing. It doesn't work the same way that we typically know. And so you have the technologists that understand the capabilities of technology, but they don't know where to apply it to. And then you have the business folks that know that I have a problem or I have an opportunity, but I don't know how to make it a reality because I don't know what the capabilities are. It's got to be kind of a little meshing of the two. I call it like a yin yang model, where they combine together and each side knows a little bit about the other side. But that's why I actually see that the non-technologists tend to be more successful with their AI startups, because they're really focused on trying to solve a problem. Whereas the technologists, they may not have the right domain knowledge. And they build something cool, and now they're trying to find a problem to wedge it into.
Yeah, I think there's gold in that alone, and it doesn't just apply to AI. It's if you focus on solving a problem, you're much more likely to have success rather than build a widget that you think is cool and then look for a problem to solve and try to force fit.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, I met some really great guys. They were very smart technologists, and they came up with a bit of a new powered movie camera using AI. And they were, they couldn't get traction anywhere. And so, someone pointed them to me and so we're chatting a bit. And, I asked them a question and it was funny. They laughed when I asked the question. They said that, every time someone asks us that question, that's when we get shown the door. And, the question I asked was, have you ever made a movie? And they hadn't. They had never made a movie. They'd never been on a set.
Yeah.
They didn't have any advisor that knew how that worked. And that was the problem is they built a camera that they thought was cool, had these AI-powered features on it, but they thought we'll apply it to movies without knowing how films are actually made. Mm. And we started talking about in films, they have different types of shots, different camera angles, different camera lenses, they have all these things. Does your camera do any of those things? Well, not really. It's just like one type of camera, but, it's so powerful, the directors and the cameramen and all that will change. And I'm just like, good luck with that one. So I think it was a hard lesson learned for them.
Yeah. All right. So now the book Own the AI Revolution. So what's the key premise behind that?
I wrote it because at the time, most of the books I saw were very technical or they were very much fear-mongering. And I didn't want people to lose hope. And I wanted people, especially non-tech people, to understand the opportunities that they had. And so I wrote On the AI Revolution with three goals in mind: education, empowerment, and enablement. And so the book is written for the layperson, for business leaders, help them understand what is AI, but more importantly, how they can actually use it, and help them understand how they can try and figure something out with it, share a couple of my frameworks with them, and then actually share the stories of other non-technologists that have started successful business units, ventures, even companies using the technology. And so essentially it was meant to educate, empower, enable, so that someone reads the book, understands a bit, can figure something out, and can take those first couple of steps on trying to build an AI solution.
Hmm. Yeah, I think we talked earlier about the scary scenarios that come to a lot of people's minds when they think AI. And so I think education is a really important thing here. Now, you do talk, you say we're already in the fourth industrial revolution. So I was trying to think back, what was the third one? I'm assuming that was the internet. But so what is the fourth industrial revolution?
That's a good question. It's essentially the digitization of all the industries, the digitization of everything that we wind up doing. So, we've gone from manual to kind of the factory to the internet, and now we're talking about where we have AI and machine learning integrated into every aspect of our lives. So, you think about self-driving cars and smart cities and, camera software like you're using that helps you, with the pictures. Mm. But we're taking this way beyond that. We're talking about AI helping us with waste management. So now you don't have to worry about, is this recyclable or is it compost or, is it landfill? You can throw it into a smart waste bin and actually sort it for you, right? We have now smart AI-powered toilets that, when you use it, it's actually analyzing your human waste and looking at biomarkers to see, are you on the onset of having a cold or a flu or a disease, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get essentially a day-by-day snapshot of your health because of this. But these are all triggering new types of jobs, new types of business processes, different disruptive innovations. Essentially, the fourth industrial revolution is going to change a lot of what we do and how we actually do it.
Do you think with COVID and with what's happening, the move to work from home and people embracing today's technology a lot more in terms of connecting remotely, do you think that's going to accelerate that fourth industrial revolution, or will people be more prepared to embrace it as a result?
I believe so, and I think we've seen some of that happening. There's the bald futurist, Steve. He, I thought, put it great when he said that COVID, while it's a horrible pandemic, is ironically the great accelerator at the same time, that it's forced us to actually try and look at and do things that we thought would either take years or would never happen. One of the things I see, I'm a part-time professor, that even at the university level, we're talking about having just fully online curriculum and virtual classrooms. Before COVID, people would say maybe 10, 15 years later, right? I mean, we have asynchronous stuff, but the synchronous, virtual live classrooms, it's not the same thing. But now you look what happened, right? With COVID, and you can't have in-person classes. Not only are we doing it, now you have a lot of active talk about, why don't we have virtual reality classrooms? Why don't we have people are sitting and they feel like they're in a, they're in a virtual environment, but they're sitting, they're interacting, they can engage, get the little thing, they can have a little AI teaching assistant helping them out. How come we're not doing that? And it's that's a total 180 on what happened.
Yeah.
And I see a lot more of that happening in other areas. Marketers and salespeople have been saying that, you still need that human connection, right? You can't just automate all that stuff away. And you're right, you can't automate all that away, but now suddenly I can't engage with you know, B2B sales in person, how do I make up the difference, right? And they're now turning to these, you know, psychographic tools and relationship type of things to try and bridge that gap. I can't tell you how many companies have said that their industry or their type of work doesn't lend itself to work at home. And now I know even some of the biggest law firms in the world are giving up their office space, saying like, we work so effectively from home, we don't need to be in the office, you know?
That's right, yeah. Once people are forced to do it, they suddenly see, hey, we can do this. And then all of a sudden, like you say, hey, there's some benefits actually. There's new opportunities, or it's more productive. I mean, I certainly realized at the start that there was a heap of time that I had available. I thought, how come I've got all this time? Because I've still got all the same work that I'm doing. And then I realized, you know, I wasn't commuting anywhere. And it was the commute that was suddenly gone. And you know, those commutes were to meet with people in person. And that's been substituted largely by online meetings with people who hadn't embraced that before, but now all of a sudden also realized, hey, this is a good way to do it, particularly when you can bring other people into the conversation. It's much easier to bring sort of three or four people together. You know, so let's say if it's a company, bring marketing and sales and maybe even have the managing director pop in for a moment. Whereas if you did an in-person meeting, that would be really hard to engineer, to find time where everybody can travel at the same time and be at that meeting.
Look, as bad as COVID is, I don't dispute that. It's been an interesting time for people that are willing to disrupt, right? I mean, you mentioned, you know, some of these new opportunities, and I see a lot of people realizing that, you know, I have an opportunity here. Things aren't going to go back to what we used to know. And this is not like a new normal. It's just the next normal. And I have a chance to shape that next normal. I could shape the future of work. I could take control of my destiny and actually do something. And I think that's really taking lemons and making lemonade out of it.
Hmm. So what do you think the impact's going to be on the job market? We talked before about doctors, you know, spending more time with patients, focusing more on the relationship, the insurance example where, you know, there's more personal attention then paid to clients that have more complex needs. What do you think overall it will be on the job market? Because, you know, combined with COVID, because with COVID, there's lots of people that now have lost their jobs because companies are paring back. And possibly they're even recognizing that they can do things differently and so they don't need as many people. So what are the opportunities out there and what impact's AI going to have?
It's interesting in that, you know, I won't sugarcoat it. Some jobs are just going to go away. They're not going to come back. We're probably not going to need taxi drivers or truck drivers. And, you know, a lot of people talk about, well, you got to learn a lot of math. You got to become a computer programmer or a roboticist. Yeah, there'll be more need for those, the data scientists, but there's actually going to be a huge demand for people that are skilled in like philosophy and the arts. Right. We're at a point now where we're entrusting machines to make recommendations and in some case decisions. And so we have to be able to think through the different scenarios how people might use or misuse a product or a technology or a solution. And then the differentiator for everything is going to become the experience you wrap around it. And so, you know, for the people that have philosophy and liberal arts degrees, you're going to be far more in demand than you realize. And I think a great example of how COVID and is going to impact this and, you know, the AI kicker on it. You think about like servers at restaurants, you know, given the pandemic, it's kind of accelerated this push to, you know, either reducing how much interaction a person has with servers and ordering through an app and getting the menu through a QR code, or even having robot servers. And they think that will probably happen. So if you're like, you're a server, what are you going to do? You have to go back to school 6 years and get a new degree or some retraining, maybe. But one thing that we've also seen is that these robot servers, how do they get trained, right? And how do you teach the atmosphere about a restaurant? And how do you teach about Snappy Banner? How do you teach about, you know, the latest in sports and all that kind of stuff? And so rather than the servers being the people that necessarily are going to be the ones serving the food anymore, they're going to be the people that are really driving customer experience, you know, the restaurant experience. And so they're going to go from, you know, the grunt work of hauling plates around to becoming the people that kind of create that differentiating experience, to become the kind of the engagement lead for restaurant patrons. And I think we're going to see a lot of that in a lot of different industries. It doesn't mean that every server is going to have their job saved. You're probably still not going to need as many people as you did before. But we also know that new types of jobs will end up getting created of all these things. So I think it really is all of us to prepare for what's going to happen, get people ready, retrained, reskilled, repurposed as necessary, while we still have the runway to actually do it. But it's also a burden on all of us to realize that, I shouldn't call it a burden, it's an opportunity, actually. We can shape what this is going to be like. Rather than wait for it to happen, be the passenger, we can be the driver that leads the change. And so if you're really worried about losing your job, I really encourage you to take advantage of this opportunity to redefine what that's going to be.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And I like that example because it highlights something around, you know, where can, you know, you talked earlier about the relationship, spending more time on the human-to-human relationship, and that's clearly something that AI, certainly at the moment, and you might correct me on that, but at the moment I would imagine that's where you can't delegate that to AI. But you could have the AI replicate an experience. And so if the server in your example, if there was a server that, you know, was really focused on creating a wonderful experience for the diners at that restaurant, and that experience was replicated. So instead of having that one server, but, you know, maybe tomorrow when you come there, you're unlucky and you get another server who doesn't actually deliver a really good experience. So you go home disappointed. Rather than that, you have these robots that replicate this wonderful experience that this server is now the creator of that experience and the trainer of the robots and the implementer of the systems that allow every single robot to provide that experience for the diners. So I see that's kind of a real opportunity there.
I think it's a huge uplift for customer service, customer experience. Right, it's not that every time you go, you're going to get the exact same experience. It's the wonderful thing about AI is that it'll learn things about you, like we'll remember what issue ate and some other things. And so the banner might be a little different. The experience might be a little bit better the next time after that. But you actually touched upon something, you know, a little bit earlier in that comment that I think is very powerful when people kind of find contradictory. I genuinely believe that AI will actually make us more human. You know, and people look at me like, how in the world is that? Because it's not a substitute for human relations, right? It's definitely not a substitute there. But by having this time freed up, right, to actually focus on customers or patients or whoever it is, and to take some of the grunt work off, I've actually seen that it's kind of creating this exploration of what it means to be human and give us an opportunity to connect at a deeper level with people. There's actually a project going on in Nairobi, Kenya right now called Loving AI. Probably not what people immediately think about, but they're set out to tackle the biggest illness in the world, which is actually loneliness. Right? 40% of the world suffers from some moderate to severe loneliness, and that was before the pandemic. So sure it's a lot worse today with COVID, but to do this, they want to give people an outlet. So it wasn't meant to substitute a human relationship, but people that felt lonely, they had some outlet where they didn't feel be judged, but they could at least talk, connect, get some confidence so they could reach out to people. And they wanted to do that by teaching AI unconditional love. Well, what is unconditional love, right? We have to teach the machine that. How do you define that, right?
Yeah.
And then what's unconditional love versus regular love? And are there different kinds of love, like the love between two spouses or the love between a parent and a child or friends or siblings, right? And so this grand research experiment about AI turned into this very deep exploration into the nature of what it means to be human. And I think we're actually wind up seeing more of that, right? When we talk about the jobs of the future, there's actually projections that we'll need a huge amount of people that are willing to be mentors, to be life coaches, to be yoga instructors, right? I really believe that AI is going to give us the opportunity to get more in touch with our own humanity.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a really interesting example. And how far down the road is that now to being implemented?
For Loving AI, they're probably still got a ways to go, right? We're talking about some very ethereal concepts.
Yeah.
Right. And we can only teach a machine something that we can commoditize. Will we get there? I feel confident we will, but I think it'll take some time.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's, you know, the traditional therapy, I guess, in the old school for loneliness was kind of get a pet. And so if you say, well, unconditional love, you know, taking aside like family members or spouses, you say unconditional love, well, the pet, you know, pet doesn't care who you are, what you've done, as long as you're paying attention to them, you're feeding them, look after them, they will give you unconditional love, right?
Yeah. You still need that human interaction, though.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's kind of the first level, right?
First step, yeah.
Like what you said with the AI, that gives you the confidence that you might be able to reach out to other humans.
Well, that's the hope, right? It's a support device, get people the confidence. I mean, I know it sounds simple.
Actually, dogs are pretty good for generating human interaction because you take the dog for a walk and then you meet all these other people taking the dog for a walk. And usually there's a conversation ensues, right? What breed is that? Or how old is he? All right. Well, that's great, Neil. On that note, I think it's a good point to move on to the Buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I have 5 questions, and hopefully you'll give us some answers that will inspire the listener to go and do something awesome as a result.
All right.
Hey, what do you think the number one thing is that people need to do to be more innovative?
You got to take risk. I mean, that's just the bottom line. I know people don't like to do that. They don't even like to make assumptions. But if you're not willing to roll the dice, it's really hard to innovate.
Hmm. So do more experiments.
More experimenting. I'm not saying jump out of a plane without a parachute, Jürgen. Right. But, you know, at least go skydiving, right, with a parachute.
Okay. Well, that's, I'm afraid of heights. So that's a big one for me. Okay, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Honestly, is think differently. That I've been fortunate enough to learn to look at different perspectives, see different viewpoints, and actually be able to mesh those together and find those hidden dots as a result and be able to connect them, right? We all hope that the innovation or that great aha moment will just kind of happen by itself. It really doesn't. You got to have the tools to make it happen.
Yeah, I like the connecting the dots aspect, because there's often things you see in other areas. And if you can connect the dots, that always comes up with new ideas. And you have to be curious, though, don't you?
You do, right? You gotta be a learner. You got to be a little bit of a learner and be, you know, you can't memorize, you conceptualize, right? Mm. So you can see how something works and say, can I do that over here too?
Yeah, that's a great way of doing it. All right, now what's a favorite resource of yours that you use a lot?
When it comes to like innovation and disruption, I actually created my own resource, Jürgen. Mm. I call it Tuckbo. Everyone talks about you have to think differently, right? But no one ever tells you how to do that. So I actually created, based on all my work, a framework called Tuckbo. So it stands for think different, understand different, be different, create different, own different. And this is a way not to just generate a successful disruptive idea, but all the steps and infrastructure you have to build to actually make it a reality. So it's something that I actually learned maybe organically and was able to put it together from all my work working with global Fortune 500 companies.
Sounds fascinating. So Tuckbo.
Tuckbo, yeah.
All right. Okay. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
You got to manage the cats, so to speak. When it comes when it comes to people, process, technology, people are still the challenge. And so it's really about ensuring people understand why we're doing something, what the value is, and most importantly, the WIFM for each stakeholder. So WIFM, what's in it for me?
Yeah. Yeah, and constant communication is involved there, right? And the Serrano app that you mentioned earlier might be kind of helpful there.
It could be. Help. Everyone should check it out.
Yeah. Great. All right. Now, what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
You got to learn to stand out and blow your own trumpet. It doesn't mean you need to be an egomaniac or arrogant, but one thing I've learned is if you sit there and do great work and you're hoping that people will recognize you for it, it doesn't really happen. You have to help people connect those dots. So if you want to stand out and differentiate yourselves, you have to be able to say why you're different. What's the value you're bringing?
That's a great point. And I guess, you know, I was having a conversation recently with someone around the typical corporate career path, and it's, you're kind of educated in the corporate world, aren't you, that you just do your job, and the assumption is if you do a good job, people will see you and you'll be successful as a result, but it doesn't actually work that way.
Not anymore, unfortunately. I mean, think about all the noise, all the stuff flying around. I mean, you got like 3 seconds to capture someone's attention. You got to find a way to blow your own trumpet, you know?
All right. So this has been fabulous, Neil. Now, where can people find out more about you and maybe even learn about the Tuckbo method and get a hold of your book and maybe even the Serrano app, because you're an advisor for that, right?
I am. So best way to get a hold of me, you can come see my website, which is my name, neilsahota.com. That's Neil, N-E-I-L, Sahota, S-A-H-O-T-A. Ask about Tuckbo, anything else you might want to. There's a contact form over there and some other information. I'm very active on LinkedIn and Twitter, so I encourage you to follow me over there and see the latest, what's happening in the world of AI and business and disruption. And, you know, if you're interested in learning more about Cyrano and their work, their website is actually Cyrano AI. It's Cyrano, like Cyrano de Bergerac, so CYRANO.AI.
All right, and we'll post links to all of those on the show notes. Now, do you have any parting advice today for our listener, Neil?
I would encourage you that, look, I know that there's a lot of stuff happening and it's not the greatest of environments, but I will tell you that some of the greatest companies started in the worst possible times. You look at like Google and Airbnb, for example. So it's all about your mindset. And I would encourage everyone to try and have an optimistic mindset, because if you can do that, not only will you feel better about yourself, not only will you be productive, you'll actually unlock those innovative opportunities. So please, you know, try and stay optimistic.
Yeah, and there's quite a lot you can do to kind of quickly reframe your mindset, isn't there? Yeah. And the first one I would suggest is stop watching the news all the time. I was having this conversation yesterday with somebody and they were saying, yeah, well, it's not news if it's good news.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately a downer. Not saying they don't provide some valuable information, but sometimes it could be framed a little less depressing.
That's right. Yeah. Talk about the hope that's there, or what we might be able to contribute to turning things around from a bad situation.
Yeah.
All right. Well, fabulous. Now, who else should I get on the InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
So, you know, being in Australia, I don't know if you've heard of a company called Lingmo, Jürgen, but I would encourage getting their CEO, Danny May, on. He's a plumber by trade. I won't steal his thunder if you get him, but he had an interesting episode in China, a work trip in China, And that launched him into a tech startup. So he learned a little bit about AI and technology and actually started a language translation AI service. So plumber to tech, right. Tech entrepreneur.
Sounds fascinating. Yeah, to linguistics. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll get a hold of Danny. Maybe we can get an introduction from you, and then we'll see if we can have a chat with him on the podcast too.
Absolutely happy to help.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Neil. This has been absolutely fabulous. Thanks for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today, and for the conversation. I've really enjoyed this. I've learned a lot more about where AI is headed and all the opportunities and how rapidly it's kind of going to impact our world and already is. So I wish you all the best for the future, and let's stay in touch.
Well, thank you. You're going to appreciate that fantastic conversation. I had a blast. And to your audience, thanks for listening.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that insightful and informative conversation with Neil and took something away from his episode. I was inspired by the various applications of AI that really focused on allowing people to spend more time on human-to-human connection, as well as the idea that the new jobs are about designing experiences that are based on that connection. I'd love to know what you took away from Neil's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Neil Sahota. That is NEILSAHOTA. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Neil Sahota. You'll also find contact information there for getting in touch with Neil, as well as links to his website, his book Own the AI Revolution, the Changing the Story podcast, his social media pages, and the other resources we spoke about in the conversation. Neil suggested we have a conversation with Lingmo founder Danny May on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So Danny, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Neil Sahota. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got more fantastic guests lined up, including Sonia Zeebeck and Dan Archow of Papillon, and Peter Newell of the innovation company BMNT. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.